Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Tonight, a special live edition of the show. In the next hour, we'll hear how a song can take flight after it leaves the songwriter's nest. Beck Hansen, better known simply as Beck, has just published, but not recorded, 20 new songs. Instead, he's letting other musicians interpret them and post songs and videos of them online. We'll talk with Beck, we'll open the phones so you can talk with him as well, and we'll hear versions of some of his songs by Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Fields and the local songwriter Amy Regan. Later, Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah evolved from an obscure synthesizer-driven track on his 1984 album Various Positions into a modern standard that's been covered countless times. We'll hear the story behind the song. But let's start with Beck's new book of sheet music. It's called Songreader, and it harkens back to a different era of music, long before MP3s, CDs, or even vinyl records. Beck joins me on the line from L.A. Beck, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this project, is it true it was kind of sparked by a Bing Crosby song?
Well, you know, I've had the idea since the 90s. I was sent a songbook version of one of my albums, which publishers tend to publish, and I was struck by how sort of obtuse the notation of the recordings were for piano and whatnot, and how it seemed sort of a forced kind of thing. So I thought, you know, writing songs for a book would actually make more sense. But the Bing Crosby thing was later on when I was researching it, I was struck by the fact that he had sold 54 million copies of sheet music, apparently, of one of his hit songs. And so the magnitude of how popular sheet music was at one time was something that was inspiring for this whole project.
So we're talking about probably the 1930s, right?
Yeah, I think it was 1937.
And 54 million people would have been, that would have been like a good third of the population, wouldn't it?
I think it was about half, actually.
Wow.
There was about 120-something people.
So, you know, music was not just a participatory experience back then, but genuinely a communal one as well. I mean, that's like almost half the country learning how to sing this song, Sweet Leilani, right?
That's right.
So you started collecting sheet music, and what happened? Did you find there was more to it than just the notes on the page that appealed to you?
I think so, yeah. Once I started to look into that whole world and realize what a big part of culture, American culture, was at one point, and how far-reaching it went into people's lives, I was really struck by how alive and strange and eccentric and you know, everything, just everything that is American culture is in this sheet music that's pretty much forgotten now.
And although, you know, in a sense it was sort of a precursor to a lot of what we have now, because sheet music often included advertising, some of it quite loud and garish.
And you're
actually sort of, you know, resurrecting that idea in the graphics for the sheet music for these various songs, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've really toiled because the project in itself is kind of a nostalgic kind of exercise in a way. And as I was really conscious of that, so I initially wanted it to be very simple and kind of stripped back, you know, just here is a collection of songs in notated form. But it was hard to deny that world, that the sheet music from the teens, 20s, 30s was so entertaining. It had so much visual life to it, and these ads, like you said, they're pretty garish and with this sort of, you know, the kind of text in the ads is really can be very strident and maybe unintentionally funny or kind of ridiculous.
And so,
and, it was a lot of fun, you know, getting into that world.
Mm-hmm. Did you do the notation? I mean, do you write music?
No, I mean, not really. I mean, you know, like any modern musician, recording technology is so accessible that notation isn't really necessary, unless you're going to have a string section or a brass section play on one of your songs.
So this is something that must have been a learning experience for you, too.
Oh, yeah. It was. I mean, that's what took the most time. And crafting an arrangement for the page is a completely different thing than recording a song.
Yeah. And so these 20 songs have been sort of like published by McSweeney's in a very handsome collection called Songreader by my guest Beck. And fans and you know, listeners have already been posting videos and audio tracks of their takes on some of the songs. Joining us here in the studio is Stephen Merritt, who is the leader of the Magnetic Fields and half of the Gothic Archies, and will be here all night if I try and go through all of the bands that he's been a part of. But Stephen, we're going to be hearing one of your versions of one of the Beck songs. What was your first reaction to this project when you heard about it?
McSweeney's, why didn't they ask me?
Now, is this, I mean, are you a sheet music collector?
I do actually collect sheet music. I was just looking at Nancy Sinatra and Frank Sinatra's duet, Something Stupid, that I have the sheet music of. And I was struck, I agree with you, Beck, that the piano reductions are generally little more than bashing out the chords and maybe doubling the melody while bashing out the chords, which is never really a good idea unless the singer doesn't know the song. And it's particularly bad in Something Stupid because there's two melodies. You're supposed to be able to identify either with him or with her. And it's thirds harmonies all the way through. But on the recording, what you're listening for really is the string lines, and that's not on the sheet music at all.
So is the problem that the sheet music that you buy as a consumer is sort of comes after the fact, and it's
yeah.
Whereas Beck, what you've done is really kind of sounds like a solution to that problem by creating something for this medium to begin with.
That's right. Yeah, and then also approaching it like it is a blueprint for the song. You know, that it's a starting point. It's, you know, I consciously tried to create something that worked and it was playable, but at the same time allowed people to kind of take it in different directions.
Mm-hmm. Well, with your song Old Shanghai, Stephen here has certainly taken it in another direction.
I wish I had brought my tuba player, though. My tuba player lives in San Francisco, so I wasn't able to do your tuba part justice. I just play it on toy piano.
Oh, right. I actually haven't heard those. I threw those in at the last moment.
the tuba part, you mean?
Yeah, I got the idea at the last minute to put brass. We had a couple extra pages and put brass arrangements for that particular song.
Well, it's a good idea.
So, but Stephen, you've decided to go stripped down here. But you know, as Beck says, it's a blueprint, right? So when you look at the notes and the words on the page, you know, how slavishly do you want to follow that?
I tried to play all of the chords. That's about as slavish as I got.
Well, why don't we hear Stephen Merritt's version of Old Shanghai with Stephen playing a toy piano that even by toy piano standards is quite small and is mounted. You mounted it on a tambourine, and the tambourine is off kilter because it's sitting on a pen. What's the point of all that?
Well, I wanted it to be as rickety as possible, and I had little bells on my fingers as well. I was trying to make the toy piano sound more like a toy piano than it really does. So maximum clatter.
Okay.
And then I decided to add some amp hum.
A little urban noise,
just yeah.
to because Shanghai is, after all, such an urban environment.
Right.
Now, Stephen recorded this right here in our studio just a few minutes before we went on the air. Beck, I think you'll like it. This is Stephen Merritt's version of Beck's Old Shanghai.
When you're walking in old Shanghai, lanterns under the night sky, see the moon begin to rise just like it did back home. Old men smoking in cafes, junk boats floating in the bay. Think of me while you're away in old Shanghai. With no ties, with no plans, your last dollar in your hands. Take a picture and send it back to someone you used to know. Things will always find their way from the back roads to the bay. There's more to do than there is to say in old Shanghai. With no ties, with no plans, your last dollar in your hands. Take a picture and send it back to someone you used to know. When you're walking in old Shanghai, lanterns under the night sky, see the moon begin to rise just like it did back home.
Stephen Merritt and his live performance on Soundcheck of Old Shanghai. He recorded that, as I said, just minutes before we went on the air. The additional overdub of, I'll call it amp abuse, because I can't imagine what else to call it, was an inspired touch, Stephen.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. I particularly liked the part where I stroke the fabric on the front of the amplifier by accident, and it sounds a lot like the wind-up bird did.
So there's a wind-up bird that we hear at the beginning and in the middle of this version of Old Shanghai, Stephen Merritt with bells on his wrists and the toy piano mounted on the tambourine. Beck, you wrote the song. What do you think?
Well, that was fantastic. That was worth doing the whole project right there.
Oh,
hearing Stephen do the song. I'm so honored to have him take that song, and that was beautiful.
Thank you. It's a fun song.
Were you going for, you mentioned back nostalgia before. Were these songs meant to sound kind of old-fashioned, nostalgic, Great American Songbook style?
Not all of them. Some of them were. That's sort of the elephant in the room, doing something like this. To ignore that kind of American songbook thing, I think, would have been a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I tried to temper it with other kinds of songs, and I tried to make it real varied. To me, it was just everything from, turn-of-the-century novelty up through, Tom Petty some modern iteration, of that sort of classic songwriting,
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Beck, whose latest release is an album in the oldest sense of the word. It is a collection of 20 songs in print, in sheet music form. It's called Song Reader. It came out last week, but Old Shanghai had been out there for a little while, so there are lots of other versions of it that you can find at the Sound Reader website. including one from the Seattle Rock Orchestra, which has a little bit of a different sound. That's the Seattle Rock Orchestra's version of Old Shanghai. There are dozens of them floating around the internet already. Stephen Merritt, you
it
went...
sounds just like mine.
The Beck song Old Shanghai is part of his Songreader project. Beck, let me read you an email or a comment that came in from Jean-David Michel, upstate New York. I would love to see Beck do a barn-style concert with all his friends gathered around a piano, Bing Crosby Christmas special style. It would be so much fun seeing them all playing and interpreting songs off the cuff. Someone call P.J. Harvey, Frank Black, and Jeff Mangum and tell them kids to suit up. The idea of playing this music is, I mean, writing it is one thing, but it's not really a song till someone else comes along and plays it, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and before, you know, recorded music, the era of recorded music and, you know, what we take for granted, CDs and records and MP3s, I mean, that was the only way to hear a song. Mm-hmm. I mean, it existed on the page solely, you know, unless you went to a music hall or a bar or something where somebody was playing piano, maybe.
Right, even there, you had no guarantee. If you heard a great song at that, you know, piano bar, you had no guarantee you would ever hear that song again. I mean, music as a repeatable experience, that really comes with sheet music first, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you'd whatever that journey to find out what a piece of music you overhear somewhere, to find it and then to get a copy and then find somebody to play it. I mean, that's a whole. I mean,
yeah.
I mean that's a whole other kind of life experience that you'll never have downloading an MP3. You know, not to romanticize that or anything, but it is interesting.
Well, in the preface to your Songreader, you write, digital developments, this is a quote, digital developments have made songs even less substantial seeming than they were on vinyl or CD. Songs have lost their cachet. They compete with so much other noise now that they can become exaggerated in an attempt to capture attention. Do you mean by that that we don't take music seriously enough because there's just so much of it now?
Yeah, I mean that's a pretty broad statement, but I think what I meant was that the general listener out there. I mean, there is so much more. I mean,
yeah.
in a world before iPhones and you know email accounts and you know whatnot, video games, all this other media that's around, it was much easier to put out a record and have people consider it and spend time and it. I don't know. There was a different. There was just a different expectation from music. Whereas now it's kind of. It seems to me, you know, and not to negate pop music now. Some of it I like a lot. It's just it is a little bit more brash and bright and simplified and kind of, you know, what sounds good over a laptop or an iPod, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A different kind of music to kind of get people's attention.
We're speaking with Beck about his sheet music project called Song Reader. Listeners, what do you think? Have songs lost their cachet in the digital age? Should we be learning how to read and make music ourselves? You can call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll take your calls. We have more with Beck, and including another live performance of one of his songs coming up in just a moment. So Beck, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. Stephen Merritt, thank you so much for coming in and giving us your version of Old Shanghai. Great to see you again.
Thank you, and thank you, Beck, for letting me do that.
Oh, thank you. I'm a huge fan of yours, and that was a beautiful version. Thank you so much for that.
Well, here at WNYC, we did a version of your song Saint Dude. The guys at Studio 360 put this together, but many of the announcers are in the band and in the chorus. Here's just a little bit of this Big Lebowski-inspired song from Beck's Song Reader.
Saint Dude, you've come a long way from your solitude. Like a sage who soothed was something crude, 'cause you know the truth is ugly.
Well, you can see and hear the entire version of Saint Dude by the Studio 360 gang, with a lot of us New York Public Radio types in the band. I'm playing one of the guitars and in the chorus, and you can see it and hear it on our website at soundcheck.org. Another and far more professional performance of one of Beck's songs coming up here in our Soundcheck studio in a moment. And we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-WNYC. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Tonight, a special live program. We're talking with Beck about Song Reader, his new collection of 20 songs in sheet music form. He's on the line with us from L.A. We want to hear from you as well. Beck was talking a moment ago about how music may have meant something different back in the days before recordings, when sheet music was how music was spread from person to person and community to community. We want to hear from you. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. In the background, you're hearing a version of Beck's Please Leave a Light On When You Go, this version by Britton Ashford. Let's take a quick call before we get back to music. Richard's with us in the Bronx. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. So, do you read music?
I have a question. I just started learning how to read music now at 30 years old. And I have been a musician all my life. I've made a lot of hip-hop music. I've even, you know, sold some stuff professionally. But what I think the value of sheet music and reading music is that now, you know, I've always wanted my music to sort of be famous and make money. But just having the discipline and having the sense of accomplishment to, like, read a classical piece of music, like I learned something by Bach recently, and it gives me so much satisfaction being able to have learned something not by ear, you know, straight from the page, that I don't even need to play for other people. You know, it gives me a sense of intrinsic gratification. Hmm. Whereas if I made a hip-hop beat, or not that it's hip-hop, but if I made a pop song or whatever, you know, I would need other people to say that it was good.
Right.
For me to feel good, and that doesn't even last most of the time. So.
Beck?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, you know, Richard's talking about gaining confidence because he's starting to learn to, you know, to read and write music. you know, does that resonate with how you felt in the course of this project?
Yeah, I mean, it has made me, the project's made me think a lot about how music was shared or disseminated, and there is something about something existing outside of a definitive recording, you know, a thing that sort of sets the tone of how people think about a piece of music, and probably you know, people are pretty, you know, have been passionate for centuries on how interpretation of classical music or, you know, music, traditional music, and it is, you know, there is something to me human about somebody in reading something off of a page and learning to play a piece of music from it, because there is that margin of error or something that can't be notated that happens when somebody learns a piece, whether he's somebody learning a piece of Bach for the first time or, you know, a Beatles song. There is that, you know, that sort of middle place where possibility happens, you know.
In the notes to the book, you mention I Only Have Eyes for You, you know, the fact that was like a show tune from the 1930s, and then decades later the Flamingos do that great version.
Yeah, which is so haunting, and there's nothing probably in that original sheet music for that song that would give you any idea that the song could be played like that.
Yeah.
That is the beauty of interpretation.
Well,
and there are probably many great songs that nobody knows of and nobody thinks of because in whatever hands they weren't turned into that definitive version.
They haven't found their flamingos yet.
Or people were thrown off by the original recording
by
an artist, different genre or something, you know.
Well, we're speaking with Beck about his Songreader project, and it's all open to interpretation. And joining us now in the studio is Amy Regan, who's a New York-based singer-songwriter who is organizing a performance next week of songs from the Songreader. It'll be next Tuesday, the 18th, at the CSC Theater, which is near Union Square. One of the songs that they're going to do is this one, Do We? We Do. Here's a live performance. Amy will sing and play the ukulele, Brendan Thomas playing the banjo, and Justin Stanton at our piano, live on Soundcheck.
Do we ever want to take the low road? Do we ever just want to say we're through? Do we want to lock the door and throw away the key? Do we do? Do we want to just look on the dark side? Do we want to wallow in the mud? Do we want to feel the world's against us? Do we do? Do we think it's sometimes just a nuisance, and other times a travesty to all who try but only fall into ruins with their broken backs up against the wall? Do we want to say it's just a fool's game, that no one but the wickedest can win? And do we want to play it with our last dimes? Oh, do we? We do. Do we want to say that things are changing, and that they're only changing for the worse? And do we want to drink while this ship's singing all those phrases just like a curse? Do we want the enemy's misfortunes to rain down like a million rotten eggs down upon the crowd?
That is Beck's song, Do We? We Do. Live performance here in the studio. Amy Regan, vocals and ukulele, Brendan Thomas on banjo, Justin Stanton at our piano. And what'd you think, Beck?
That was great. Lovely.
Amy, one of the advantages of, you know, reading sheet music while the composer is practically in the room is you can ask questions. If there is anything that you were wondering about or confused about, here's your chance to ask Beck.
Well, one of the things I love about Beck's song reader is there are so many little tongue-in-cheek details that he's put in, like the expression marks. I kind of can't tell when he's being serious and when he's not being when he's not being serious. So this song, Do We Do, it says to play it rhetorically. So, in fact, can you tell us, did we play it rhetorically enough?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yeah, it kind of is rhetorical.
Now, but the song that we recorded, by we, I mean the on-air staff here at WNYC, St. Dude, the mark there is not moderato or with, you know, gentle swing or anything like that. It's abiding, as in the dude abides from,
right.
from the Big Lebowski. So a little in-joke there for film fans. What do you plan to do, Beck, with these songs? Are you going to eventually record them?
I don't know. I've been wanting to let people have at it first, you know, and like I was saying before, there is something about a recording by an artist that kind of sets the tone for a song or becomes a sort of, you know, something that people base their versions off of. And I like the idea of people kind of being left to their own devices to really figure out what they think about the song. But, yeah, I'll probably play some of these songs live, you know, eventually. And I'm sure, you know, they'll find homes elsewhere as well.
Well, it's a wonderful project. And, Amy, you guys are doing all 20 songs, is that right?
That's our goal.
We're
pretty close.
Wow.
We've learned a lot of them. Yeah, I've spent
very
a lot
ambitious.
Of time. Yeah, it's been a very fun 2 weeks that I've been curled up with sheet music.
All right, so Amy and her cast of thousands will be at the CSC Theater next Tuesday night, December 18th here in New York near Union Square to run through as many of those 20 songs as they can do. It's December 18th. And, Beck, it has been so much fun having you with us on the show tonight and getting a chance to hear some of these songs. It's such a handsome volume. The folks at McSweeney's did a great job. You must be really happy.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm a huge fan of McSweeney's, and they really did. I mean, this song really exists as a book, you know. The songs are there for those who want it, but it really is a kind of piece of printed work.
Well, congratulations. And
thanks
again,
to McSweeney's.
Thanks for joining us on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Beck is the singer, songwriter, and producer whose latest release is this collection of 20 songs in sheet music form called Song Reader. And Amy Regan, you and the boys, thank you for coming in and playing for us. You have a little song to play us out with?
Yes, we do.
This one is America, Here's My Boy, another Beck original.
He came into this world helpless and unformed. I held him in my arms as he lay newly born. I said I would protect him and soothed him with my voice. America, here's my boy. I taught him to say words and stand up on his feet.
Just a little more from Amy Regan and Friends and another song from the Beck Song Reader. We're back in just a moment with the book about the song Hallelujah. This is Soundcheck.
Should be sung with joy.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's possible you might have first heard this song in its original form on the 1984 album Various Positions by Leonard Cohen. As I say, it's possible, but not probable. it's much more likely you heard someone else sing it first, maybe Jeff Buckley in a small East Village pub, or at the Winter Olympics being sung by Katie Lang. Or, for millions, it was the soundtrack of the animated film Shrek, a version sung by Rufus Wainwright here. The song is Hallelujah, and it has, against all odds, become one of the most widely recorded songs in music history. Alan Light, a frequent contributor to the New York Times and Rolling Stone, is author of a new book called The Holy or the Broken, Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and the Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah. He joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Alan, good to see you.
Hi, John.
1984 to now is, you know, there's a long stretch of time there, but it's still one song. You've built a whole book around one song.
It was an ongoing process of convincing myself that there really was enough story here to fulfill a project, to sustain a project like this. And much to my pleasure and ongoing surprise, around every corner, there turned out to be more story and more to talk about. And what started as kind of an idle thought that maybe this is interesting actually, you know, turned into a whole book here.
And it is an interesting tale, although one of the storytellers here, and you interview many people, one of the storytellers is missing, and that is Leonard Cohen himself.
Well, Leonard does very, very little in the way of interviews. Mm-hmm. I know that you had Sylvie Simmons on recently for her biography of Leonard that he participated in, and that was kind of his one thing that he would, you know, the one person he would talk to in recent years. So I wanted his blessing and his support, and he, through his manager, very enthusiastically gave that. But it also occurred to me that, you know, for a song with as much mythology now and as much mystique and aura around it as Hallelujah, what does he really have to gain by talking about it? I mean, if he told me, you know, I thought of that line while I was brushing my teeth, like what's he going to do that's going to add to the legacy of the song at this point?
Right. Well, and in terms of the legacy of the song, you kind of hinted it right in the title. The Holy or the Broken, Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and the Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah. For many people, this is as much, and you write this essentially in the book, this is as much Jeff Buckley's song as it is Leonard Cohen's.
Well, it's certainly true that at this point, more people have come to this song through Jeff Buckley, either immediately through him or through all of the artists that he influenced that learned it through his version. That really is the way that the song began to really disseminate through the world. So, you know, if Leonard was the author of this song, Jeff was really the interpreter where it starts to pivot and where the song starts to take on all of this afterlife for years and years.
Now, Jeff Buckley released it on his first album and really his only
album, really,
full-length record,
on the Grace album. And, you know, what's interesting is that the impact that Jeff has had through other artists has been so great that I think a lot of people who've come to him more recently feel like he must have been this big star that was taken away. But the fact is, when Grace came out, Grace was a massive disappointment. There was a lot of hype and expectation around Jeff. The album, you know, peaked around number 153 on the charts or something. So, you know, we look at it now and say, oh, Jeff Buckley popularized this song. But even when he first did it, it really wasn't that popular. It took, you know, his death several years later and all the sort of romance and tragedy and the image that grew up around him that started to give this song an additional layer. And then it starts to snowball from there.
This is Jeff Buckley's version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, recorded in 1994, so it's about 10 years after Leonard Cohen's original recording, from Jeff Buckley's one and only full-length record, Grace.
Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof, her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. And she tied you to her kitchen chair, and she broke your throne, and she cut your hair, and from your lips she drew.
That, Ellen Light, that is the version that I first heard. Jeff Buckley, the ill-starred singer, songwriter, his version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, recorded in 1994. I was very lucky to have known Jeff Buckley at the very beginning of his career. One of his earliest performances was on one of my New Sounds Live concerts here in New York. So when this came out, it was, as I say, the first that I heard of it. Where did he get it from?
Well, Jeff Buckley actually did not learn the song from Leonard Cohen's performance, and actually said that when he first started performing it in you know, at Chennai and at the small clubs
small
in town
clubs
that he was playing, that he hadn't heard Leonard Cohen's version. He learned it through a version that John Cale had recorded on a Leonard Cohen tribute record. There were actually a couple of Leonard tribute records that were done early in the 90s when he had a bit of a resurgence in his career, and a lot of the sort of alt-rock world stepped up to say this was an important guy. And John Cale.
You mentioned Nirvana sort of shouting out to Leonard Cohen.
And Trent Reznor using some Leonard songs on the Natural Born Killers soundtrack. There was sort of some attention around Leonard for a minute there. And John Cale had been approached to participate. It was a French rock magazine that put together this tribute called I'm Your Fan. And
A takeoff on
I'm Your Man.
I'm Your Man.
Yes. And interestingly, even John Cale, who was a big Leonard fan and actually knew Leonard, said that he had gone to see Leonard sing at the Beacon Theater in 88 or 89, and he sang Hallelujah, and John Cale didn't know the song. You know, various positions, when Leonard recorded it, Columbia first rejected it. The label didn't put the album out. It then came out on a small independent first, and the song was not noticed. The review in Rolling Stone, which is positive review, didn't mention the song, and it was absolutely not under the radar. It was not anywhere near the radar. So John Cale heard this song and thought, well, that's a song I like. That's a song maybe I could do, but he didn't know the words. He had only heard it that time. So he called Leonard's office and said, I want to get the words right on this. Can you send me the lyrics so that I get this, you know, do this the right way? Leonard says that he struggled with the writing of Hallelujah for several years, 2 or 3 or 4 years, depending when he's telling the story, and wrote 75, 80 verses, recorded one version of it, but then immediately started altering it as soon as he was performing it in concert. So he faxed to John Cale 15 pages of lyrics and kind of said, do what you want out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And Cale came up with a different edit than what Leonard had recorded, and it was that version that Jeff Buckley first heard, and that edit of the lyrics that he recorded on Grace, and kind of, you know, I can't say solidified the song because it continued to change, but became what, you know, what most of the world looked at as the definitive version.
But it was John Cale, former member of the Velvet Underground back in the 60s, who in 1991 did this kind of important intermediate step in making Hallelujah the hit it's become.
There was a time you let me know what's really going on below, but now you never show it to me, do you? I remember when I moved in you and the whole
John Cale and his version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah from a tribute record called I'm Your Fan, a takeoff on the Leonard Cohen song title, I'm Your Man, which came out in 1991. That's the version that Jeff Buckley heard en route to his own recording, which has become sort of the iconic version of the song, as detailed in Alan Light's new book called The Holy or the Broken, Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and the Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah. So, Alan, we almost got your title in that verse there. It's cold or broken here. The holy or the broken is yet another verse that so many of these verses are sort of idiosyncratic to whoever's doing the song.
Well, and that's one thing that really propelled this song into a different place was, I think, because it took so long and these various different versions and manifestations to sort of get out into the world, there's an understanding that you're allowed to alter, to take what you want from mm-hmm. the lyrics of these songs and to turn up or turn down the different elements that are in there. There's if you want it to be a more religious, a more spiritual song, you can emphasize that. If you want more the heartbreak and sorrow, you know, you work it around that way. And all of that is okay. And that's very, very different than these other sort of modern standards. A song like Imagine, mm-hmm. you know, Yoko Ono says she gets requests every week from people who want to record Imagine. They just want to change that line, Imagine No Religion.
Right.
You know, and she says, well, I can't do that. And anybody that performs Imagine exists in some relation to John Lennon's recording. It's the same. It's different. It does this or that. With Hallelujah, there's this malleability.
Because there are so many verses, all his. But as you say, some of them sort of revel in this kind of erotic imagery. Many of them pull from the biblical imagery, right. You know, David, King David composing the Psalms.
David's story, the Samson story. I mean, very literal biblical references that are in there.
Right.
You know, and Leonard Cohen always has trafficked in these, you know, tensions between the sacred and the sexual and the spiritual and the secular. And that is built into what his writing has always done. But this song, you know, those elements are there in very stark ways that enable you, you know, this is a song that's appeared on, you know, the Susan Boyle's Christmas record, for better or for worse,
yeah.
That's been sung by, you know, punk bands, pop bands, you know, Paramore, Fall Out Boy, some of these bands that incorporated it into songs of their own. There's a lot of different pieces to pull from.
And as if, you know, taking on biblical and sexual imagery in the same song wasn't enough. I mean, after all, that goes back to the Song of Solomon. He's also writing about writing music.
About writing, right.
You know, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth. He's describing how he's writing
how,
the song.
Yeah, it's right. And, you know, with this very sort of irresistible and elemental kind of melody. I mean, I think you can get very caught up in just talking about the words, and obviously the words are very important in a Leonard Cohen song, but if it didn't have a melody that, you know, opera singers can sing or Willie Nelson can sing mm-hmm. and get away with it, then, you know, if you don't react to that first, the song's not going to go much farther. And the basic power of the word and that idea of Hallelujah is so strong across faiths, across people, you know, without faith, but who want some sort of spiritual release. There's something about that idea that just hits everyone so universally that it opens an awful lot of doors.
And yet it didn't hit everyone universally. In fact, it was, as you say, almost universally ignored when Leonard Cohen himself recorded it back in 1984. And as you listen to this original version of Hallelujah from Leonard Cohen's various positions, maybe you'll hear why.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing Hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
Now remember, this is 1984, and Alan, This original version of the song by Leonard Cohen is full of the sounds of 1984.
It's absolutely right. It's actually, this is the album that sort of began a, you know, second part of his career obsession with synthesizers for the way that Leonard Cohen made records. And you're absolutely right. You can hear the latest electronics of 1984 all over that song.
And his own engineer hated how this turned out.
Well, it was, you know, I wouldn't say hated, but, you know, it was not what she, you know, and this is an engineer who's worked with him through the rest of his career.
Right.
But said, you know, maybe that wasn't exactly the sound that she would have wanted to hear. You know, and this is also 1984, possibly the biggest year in pop music history. I mean, this is the year of Purple Rain, Born in the USA, and Like a Virgin, when MTV is ruling, you know, everything about music. So it's very easy to look back and say, who are these idiots at the record company who heard this song that would become a classic and wouldn't put it out? But, I think they were much more concerned with keeping up with demand for Bruce Springsteen records at the
right.
time than a 50-year-old poet, you know, singing this
with a
sort
full
of
on chorus and these yeah. kind of cheesy synths. And yeah.
And so it's, you know, I think that there's some, I think in hindsight, it's easy to be harsher on that decision than what it was in the moment.
The book is called The Holy or the Broken, Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and the Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah. Alan Light is the author. Worst version of Hallelujah.
Well, there's two I've got that I have to return to as worst version. You know, I don't have a problem with Susan Boyle singing this song. It's easy to just dismiss it. But the edit that she does to the lyrics just butchers. I mean, it's actually meaningless. It cuts off in the middle of a verse. It's evident that she just wanted to be able to sing that chorus. Hmm. And it didn't matter what else was there around that. And so that is kind of horrifying.
Baby, I've been here before. I've seen this room. And I've walked this floor. I used to live alone before I knew you.
And the other one that's just, you know, the biggest swing and a miss was Bono did it for another Leonard tribute record in the mid-90s and did it as kind of a trip-hop version that recited the lyrics and then goes into this falsetto on the chorus. And what's funny about this is I spoke to Bono for the book, and I'd written about all the reasons that this version is such a disaster, and it took a long time to reach him because he's Bono.
Right.
And then finally he gets on the phone, and I'm like, oh, my God, he's going to tell me, you know, the big defense of his version. I'm going to have to rewrite this whole section. And he got on the phone, and he said, Alan, I couldn't remember why I said I was going to do this interview, and then I remembered it's because I have to apologize to everybody. You know? And just said, look, I know what I was trying to do. I never should have put that out. It's just, you know, it was an experiment that I just should have left on a shelf. And so, you know, this is the right thing for him to say, and I'm glad he could, you know, show the humor about it,
well,
at least in the mirror.
Now we have to hear it. This is a little bit of Bono's version of Hallelujah.
Your faith was strong, but you need a proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty in the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair. She broke your throne. She cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah.
Bono's version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
John, you're speechless.
It's radio. It's not TV. But if it were TV, listeners, you would see disbelief on my face.
Now, you know.
I've somehow missed that version.
There you go, Alan. You can say how much
Alan.
Your life. Yeah. But, you know, listen, Bono, he said to me, you know, this may be the most perfect song ever written, was his description. And he's brought it on the last U2 tour. They started using it. Doing the first verse as an intro into Where the Streets Have No Name. Mm. You know, he certainly made his peace enough with it to be able to go back and has always professed his you know, deep admiration for Leonard Cohen. you can see what he was trying to do with that version.
Yeah. Alan Light's book is called The Holy or the Broken. It tells the story of the amazing trajectory of the song Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. And with all of the hundreds of versions that are now out there, anything recent that has surprised you in a good way?
There's a you were saying before, you get so lost in talking about the words to this song and talking about Leonard's writing and the poetry and all that, that sometimes you don't think enough about the melody. And there was an instrumental version that the ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro recorded last year that's really, really gorgeous. And, you know, I spoke to him for the book and he's like, this isn't about the words at all to me. This is about the way these chords work and what this melody is. And there's something really, at least for me, after having spent so much time talking about this verse or that verse or this version or whatever, just to hear what is actually behind that song. It sounds just gorgeous. You know, at that moment, I kind of needed an injection of that. So I don't think we're done yet.
All right. Well, and good thing, too, because it has become a standard. It is still a great song. Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah is the subject of Alan Light's book called The Holy or the Broken. Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and the unlikely ascent of Hallelujah. Alan, great to see you again.
Thanks so much, John.
This is Soundcheck. And speaking of Jeff Buckley, I mentioned how we sort of knew him way back when. You can find on our website some of his earliest live performances on one of my New Sounds Live concerts from early 1992. It's on our website at soundcheck.org. And that's going to do it for the program tonight. Tomorrow, our regular contributor Joe Levy of Billboard magazine talks about this year's crop of Grammy nominees. We have live music from the Pigpen Theater Company and more. That's tomorrow at 9, right here on Soundcheck. See you then. In the meantime, check us out online at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer.